Hello, and welcome to episode 517 of the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast. My name is Seth Ferdinand, historian and deputy director of the Mississippi Armed Forces Museum. And with me, as always, is my co-host, good buddy, John Parshall. How are you this fine July 22nd, John?
I'm hanging in there. As you know, I suffered a computer crash over the weekend and had to go
Yes.
out and buy myself a new box. And so I'm in the process of hauling down terabytes worth of cloud backups from the old machine and reinstalling all the applications. And I'm deep in the editing for the 1942 thing. And it's just, my hair is on fire and I don't even have any hair. So, yeah. I'm
Well,
doing
no,
great.
clearly it's on fire because it's not there anymore. It's gone.
Anyway.
It's gone.
So
Yeah.
this will be good. A little distraction, a little chat about Pearl
Indeed.
Harbor. Let's do this thing.
Indeed. Yeah, we've been building up to this for crying out loud. I don't know, weeks. Weeks and weeks and weeks. So here we go. This is going to be the beginning of the attack on Pearl Harbor. So the warships cleaved through the seas at 24 knots, their crews on high alert. The six carriers were in the middle of the formation, surrounded by escorts, the tiny destroyers ringing the formation of Japanese ships like sheepdogs watching for wolves. The battleships Kirishima and Hiei, which had been in the middle of the vanguard during the night to guard against any unforeseen encounters, began slipping to the sides of the flotilla. The carriers began loosening their formation to gain the room for conducting flight operations. At around 0330, the pilots began to stir. In the ready rooms, the pilots anxiously tuned the radio to KGMB, Radio Honolulu. Soft Hawaiian music drifted over the airwaves, an indication that the fleet had not been sighted. Surprise might very well be achieved. Strike Commander Fuchida Mitsuo donned his red underwear, which I think is pretty cool, and we can get to that in a minute.
Right.
Met his compatriot Murata Shigeharu in the wardroom and grinned as the latter polished off a large breakfast. These men, the leaders of the strike, were confident. The plan was reviewed again by the pilots. The men studied the blackboard with the layout of the island's airfields, the harbor, and the American ships in it, went through their various assignments in their heads, and ran for the flight deck. As the first air fleet approached the launching point, the fleet's commander, Vice Admiral Nagumo Chuichi, turned to his air officer, Commander Genda Minoru, and said, quote, "I have brought the task force successfully to the point of attack. From now on, the burden is on your shoulders," unquote. Genda smiled and replied, quote, "Admiral, I am sure the airmen will succeed," unquote. And boy, will they. At 0550, the carriers turned their bows into the wind as the famous Z flag from the Battle of Tsushima whipped at the halyard. 15 minutes later, Lieutenant Commander Itaya Shigeru screamed down Akagi's flight deck in his A6M, the first man to launch from the flagship. His zero dipped as Akagi's bow dipped. The watchers on the flight deck gasped. Then Itaya pulled up, gained altitude, and climbed. The attack was on. On Oahu, Sunday, December 7th, was like any other day. Peaceful, calm, quiet. The weather was very Oahu-like, 73 degrees and partly cloudy. Admiral Kimmel was up and getting dressed for his regular golf day with General Walter Short. Sailors aboard the ships in port were stirring, many getting dressed and ready for the day's activities, which for most were none. For most, this Sunday was shaping up like any other Sunday in Pearl Harbor, at least for now. For others, something was different, something was odd. Just off the entrance to the harbor, Lieutenant William Outerbridge and the destroyer USS Ward were patrolling lazy laps at the mouth. During the early morning, Outerbridge had received a report of a submarine periscope in an area where no periscope should ever be. An hour later, he received another report, this one a definite sighting of a potential submarine. As Ward pulled in close at 0640, the OOD saw what looked like a conning tower trailing the USS Antares. Outerbridge assessed the situation and called for general quarters. High above the beaches at Opana Point, two young Army privates, Joseph Lockard and George Elliott, were shutting down their mobile radar station, their work complete, and their three-hour shift over. The men were getting ready for chow. As Lockard was about to power down the set at 0702, the scope suddenly showed an enormous radar image. At first, the men thought the site was malfunctioning. It wasn't. Another check revealed the image was indeed accurate, estimated to be 50 plus aircraft coming in from the northeast, range 132 miles, and closing fast. Ba ba ba. All right. So, what is the situation in Kita Butai and First Air Fleet, even before all this is going on? What's going on this morning?
The first thing that a lot of the people are aware of up on the bridge, and soon the pilots when they get up on the deck, is that the weather is still really bad. This force had transited through extremely heavy weather coming down, and the night before, when they begin their high-speed run, they turn directly south and they kick it up to 24 knots to, leave the oilers behind, fuel up, and then move on down at a very fast clip to get north of Oahu. And the seas are still very heavy this morning. I forget the extent of the winds, but there was a lot of wind, and it was just a nasty time to have to be taking aircraft off, which gives you a sense for just the professionalism in this force that they could even launch under these conditions, let alone carry out this attack. I think that certainly among the pilots, you had the normal pre-combat jitters, and it spanned the gamut, depending on the individual. Some of these men were extremely cool customers. They were very well trained. They knew their business, and I think as Genda and some of the others said, they were confident that they were going to be able to pull this off. Others, I'm quite certain, were nervous as hell and probably
Sure.
hadn't slept all night.
Yeah.
So.
Going back to the red underwear thing,
Yeah.
that Fuchida wore, I mean, it's a real deal. And Murata did it too. Murata had red underwear too, and it was red drawers, and I
Yeah.
think he had a red scarf or red shirt, if I remember correctly,
Yeah, I think
underneath it.
that's
And
right.
it wasn't for bravado, although kind of sorta. It was, according to Fuchida, is that if he got hit, the blood wouldn't be as
Prominent. Yeah.
prominent.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't, freak out the guys. So,
Yeah.
they were expecting to run into some trouble. They didn't think they were going to get off scot-free.
Yeah, exactly. And the expectations for this operation at some points were they thought they might end up losing half the carriers, in the course of carrying this thing off. So everybody understood that this was a really big deal. Obviously, this is a no one would have expected to have been in this position a year ago, that you are going to attack the Americans' most important fleet base in the Pacific by surprise, and we're bringing the whole shooting match to this thing, all six of our big carriers, basically every plane that we can put on those carriers. And that's another thing that sometimes gets lost. This is absolutely an all hands on deck kind of operation, in that they were stripping out some of the more modern aircraft from some of the other smaller carriers in order to beef up the air wings on these six attack carriers. That's one of the reasons that even as far in the future as Battle of Coral Sea, when the carrier Shoho goes into action, she's still rocking some of those older A5M clawed fighters. She doesn't have a full complement of Zeros, in part because a Japanese aircraft production was nothing to write home about, even on the eve of a war. And they'd stripped a lot of those fighters out to put them on Kyudabutai for this attack. One of the things that you'll see is as we reviewed that in some of the footage leading up to this, there is Japanese footage of them transiting, and you can see them using deck parks on their carriers because they had so many aircraft, the hangars were bursting at the seams with planes so that they could beef up these air groups and make them as big as possible. They normally didn't like transiting with deck parks. They didn't like exposing their aircraft to salt water corrosion and that kind of stuff. But again, the importance of this tack was so high that, yeah, these carriers will never have as big air groups as they are rocking for this operation.
And the targets, the targets are, obviously we've said this, everybody knows this, but we're going to say it again. The targets for the main attack are going to be, several things around Oahu, but for the anchorage attack, they're hoping to catch the American carriers in port, and they're hoping to, in a way, kind of catch them in deep water. And to that extent, the Japanese launched two cruiser scout planes, and one of them goes to Pearl, and the other one goes to Lahaina, and
Lahaina,
let's
which is used as an alternate anchorage sometimes
mm-hmm.
by the Pacific Fleet. So they're snooping out both of these anchorages. They had already gotten a report from the Japanese consulate and the spy who was working in that consulate that it did not look as if there were American carriers in port. So they had that report in hand on December the 6th, Tokyo time. It's now December 8th, Tokyo time. So there was a general belief that the carriers were not going to be there, but who knows, maybe one of them came back during the night or something like that. It's not beyond the realm of possibility. And so, yes, they launched these two cruiser planes to get up there and do some scouting reports before the attack comes in to do sort of a last minute verification of what's there.
So let's talk about the launch sequence. The
Yeah.
weather was bleh in the
Blech.
morning, but the launch sequence goes pretty damn well.
Pretty well. They do have a number of mechanical aborts. I think there's a total of five out of the initial attack wave. But this is something that the Japanese are really good at by this point in the war, is getting airplanes up and getting them formed up. So you've got six carriers in the formation. This is the only time that these six carriers will operate as a single group. And I don't know the actual end-to-end of the beginning of the launch to the end of the launch. It's probably on the order of 20 minutes or something like that, is it not?
Which is astounding. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
Yeah.
quick. Yeah. I mean, they get them up, and that's the thing that it's so mind-boggling. And that's another conversation for later, is that they're the Japanese carrier operations, their deck
Deck load
ops.
strikes. Yep.
Yeah, we're so good
Yeah.
for
Yeah.
lack, they were just quick. They were just professional. Boom, 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 boom. And then you look at the
Yep.
things that, we're struggling to, we're tripping over our own feet.
Even us.
Hell, even at Santa Cruz, we're tripping over our own feet to get, deck load strikes off in a timely
Yeah.
manner.
Well, the Japanese had made some fairly rational decisions in terms of how they did deck operations, that they did not try to break their strikes up and bring additional birds up from the hangars in the middle of these launches. They would just, we would put a package on the deck that fit conveniently on the deck, and that's usually between 27, maybe 30 aircraft or so. That's the amount that we can get off. And it depended to a degree on how many cap fighters would be added to that initial launch as well. That was also typical. There's not just strike planes going off on this, they're also launching the initial cap watch as well. And those are some very disappointed lads because they are not going to be participating in the main attack. They've got to run cap. But in any case, you've got this package of 30 planes, maybe 33 tops, and depending on the size of the flight deck. And yeah, you just get them all off in one swell swoop. And away they go. But yeah, they would typically be launching these planes at the rate of one every 20 or 30 seconds. And up they go. And they all have what I want to call assembly areas that are outboard of wherever the carrier is. So if you're in the starboard column, you're going to be launching your planes. They're going to go further off to starboard and just loiter over one of the battleships or the cruisers or whatever. Once we've got the whole group, put together, then all six of those groups come together into their various packages. And it was very sophisticated too, up in the air, in that you had, groups of fighters, groups of dive bombers, not necessarily carrier by carrier. In many cases, they would be division by division. So with respect to the attack on the anchorage with the torpedo planes, it's going to be the Akagi and Kaga torp planes that are going to go after Battleship Row. It is the Soryu and Hiryu group that are going to go after the other side of Ford Island, where Utah and some of those other ships are located. So they typically organize their strike aircraft in divisional size chunks, but then put them all up together. All of those torpedo planes are transiting basically as a group, knowing that when they get north of the harbor, they're going to split
Going to
into
split.
two and come in. So, yeah, what you see here is the results of 6 months of very hard work on the part of the Japanese. Again, back to April 1st, 1941, when the order was given, okay, we're going to build this thing called Kita-Butai. They've had to do a lot of nuts and bolts figuring
Sure.
out of how do we launch, how do we group, how do we transit, how do we attack, and all of that stuff has been ironed out. It's a really tremendous accomplishment.
You're building the wheel is what you're
Yeah,
doing here. You're
building the
building the wheel.
wheel. That's a good
Yeah.
way of putting it.
So the first wave which is what this episode, by the way, just to be clear so everybody understands, this episode is the first wave. Next week we'll talk about the second wave. So there's too much to talk about when we'd be here for 5 hours. That being said, the first wave consists of 183 aircraft, is what gets off the flight decks and gets going. It's 43 Zeros, 40 Kates with torpedoes, 51 Vals, 49 Kates with the AP bombs. And of course, the AP bombs are what we talked about, the 16-inch shell that's been,
Machined
configured.
down into a teardrop shape and put fins on and all that stuff.
Fuchida leads this first wave with, and he breaks it up into three groups. Give us the skinny on the three groups.
So the first group is basically slated for attacking the anchorage. So you've got here your high-level Kates with the AP bombs, you've got your low-level Kates with torpedoes on them, and so there's a mixture here. 16 Kates from Hiryu and Soryu are going to be coming in with torpedoes against the other side of Ford Island. 24 Kates from Akagi and Kaga that are torpedo armed are going to be coming against the anchorage against Battleship Row, and then the remainder again 49 with the AP bombs. They're supposed to be 50. They're flying in Vics of 5. And they have groups from each of the four main carriers, Akagi, Kaga, Soryu, and Hiryu. The dive bombers are all packaged in group number two. And the dive bombers are coming from the two junior carrier groups, Shokaku and Zuikaku. And those planes, they're going to be 25 Vals from Zuikaku. They're going to hit Hickam and then head over to, excuse me, not Hickam. Wheeler. They're going after Wheeler. And then after Wheeler, they're going to bingo over to AWWA and, shoot it up and strafe it as need be. Meanwhile, the remainder, they're going to be, Ford Island is going to be hit by 9 Shokaku Vals, and Hickam is going to be hit by 17 more Shokaku Vals. Then group three is basically all of your air supremacy assets, all the zeros, and they're going all over the place. They are accompanying both the strike packages. So there's going to be 14 zeros that are going to go against Ford Island, 18 zeros against Hickam, 14 are going to be going to Wheeler and then over to AWWA after the Wheeler attack. And then finally, 11 zeros are going to go after Kaneohe from the outset to get rid of the PBYs that are over there so that again, the Americans won't be able to send up scout aircraft and snoop out this force.
So it's a
It's
big
big,
strike. It's a
big
big strike.
strike.
It's the biggest strike of carrier-borne aircraft to this point in history.
And
I
it's
mean,
going to
this is
be the
it.
biggest strike all the way up until we get to the American raids on Truk in
Jeez.
Feb of 1944,
And
which
that's saying
gives you,
something.
It gives you no other navy in the world could have done this attack at this point in time. Not the British, not the Americans. The Japanese are the only people that could have pulled this off.
Rather amazing when you think about it. So, taking a sort of a step forward, because they begin, these guys get up at 0330-ish. At 0342, USS Condor, which is a minesweeper, is patrolling outside the harbor when her officer of the deck, a gentleman named Ensign McCloy, spots what he believes to be a submarine periscope. We talked about this in the intro. They immediately send a message over to Ward, which is the patrolling DD. Hey, come check this out. We think we got a periscope up here. It's making a little rooster tail, and you need to come see this. Ward does that, goes over there, of course, can't find a dang thing. They
It's
patrol. Go ahead.
middle of the night, and so
They patrol for well over an hour, and in that area, I'm sorry, 30 minutes, and they can't find squat. Like Outer Bridge calls his crew to GQ, they're doing their thing, can't find a damn thing. More than likely, a whale, is probably what they're thinking. Conversation begins via TBS between Ward and Condor. They're trying to pinpoint the area, trying to bring Ward into exactly where they saw it. And again, searches,
nothing.
nothing, not a damn thing. Fast forward about another 3 hours-ish. USS Antares is making her way into the harbor. She's towing a I think it was a garbage barge, if I remember correctly.
Something like or a target barge, I can't remember. Yeah, something like that.
Something like that. It's just a big barge behind her as she's coming in. They're opening up the anti-submarine nets, which have actually already been opened, because there's a lot of ships that are transiting in and out of the harbor this morning. And Pearl Harbor's a working base. Not everybody's just sitting there,
Right,
sleeping on
twiddling
a
their
Sunday
thumbs,
morning.
right?
Yeah, there's things going on. There's destroyers coming and going. There's different ships coming and going. So the submarine nets have been open for a while. And instead of closing them consistently and opening, open and close, open and close, they're just leaving them open because they know there's a lot of traffic coming in and out.
Because we're not in a
Well,
war.
ex yeah,
Right.
exactly. Exactly. And we're not supposed to be attacked. The Philippines are supposed to be attacked. We're not
Right.
supposed to be attacked. Well, as Antares is moving closer into the harbor, there's a PBY that's above the area, and
Yeah.
it's circling over Antares, not over Antares, but over the general vicinity, clearly looking at something. There's something in the water that is attracting their attention. And this is your Minnesota crew
Yeah.
destroyer here.
Yeah, that's right.
And this all starts to snowball from here, John.
Right. Yeah, so the ward is, man, there's a lot of Minnesota reserve people on the ward, and the captain, Outerbridge, has just taken command of this ship yesterday, as we have described in the previous episode. And this is going to sort of factor into some of the communication snafus that are going to happen this morning, in that a lot of the people, I think, in Pearl Harbor proper, when they start getting reports from the ward, they're filtering it through. This guy doesn't know what he's talking about. He's a total greenhorn. He just took over this ship and he's all skittish, and and they got a bunch of reservists on this ship. In any case, it's an old four piper. And so there's, I think, some emotional discounting of some of the things that Ward ends up talking about as a result. But the net net is the that's a terrible pun right there. The net net is that the OOD again at 0640 sees something and summons Outerbridge to the bridge. He was lying in his bunk, and Outerbridge gets up on the bridge, takes a look at this thing, and he's like, yeah, absolutely, that is a submarine conning tower, and it is basically between the Antares and the barge that it is towing. And so this conning tower is trailing right along behind the Antares and is catching up to her, at which point Outerbridge sends the ship to GQ, and they begin moving in on this target.
They move in immediately. And Outerbridge, he doesn't hesitate, and he has a pretty good war history. We could talk about that at another time. He actually winds up having to sink his old ship later on in the
I
Philippines, but
remember that. That's right. Yeah.
yeah. But regardless of this, he's moving in on this thing. He doesn't hesitate at all. He immediately orders open fire because husband Kimmel had issued an order, what, like 4 or 5 days previous,
Right.
that said that
Any
if there's,
submarine.
yeah, if
Any
there is a
submarine.
submarine operating in that area,
Sink it.
sink it and let, an American flag is going to be flying, hopefully from a surface submarine as it's entering Pearl Harbor. But
Right.
if it ain't, you sink that sucker and you sink it now. So he's following orders from husband Kimmel, and
Yeah.
he brings Ward up to hell from 100 yards away. The first shot is fired from mount number one on Ward, and it sails right over the conning tower of this little
Yep.
thing and misses it. As he's pulling closer, Outerbridge, he describes it. He says it's about 80 feet long. It's definitely a submarine, and it's definitely not an American submarine. Doesn't look like
Right.
anything that we have in our inventory. And as they get closer, and I'm talking close, Jackson, this 50 yards away
Yeah,
is when
that's
mount number three, pow, punches
wow.
that thing right at the base of the conning tower.
Yep.
And
And it's funny because for years the guys off of the ward were
yeah.
not necessarily believed,
Right.
but they all swore up and down, no, we drilled that sucker neat as neat right through the sail. And sure as hell, when they finally found the submarine a
I
number of
mean, it's
years ago, boom. I mean, yeah, it certainly it must have killed the crew just
oh,
outright.
yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, shrapnel
Absolutely.
down into the command spaces, and glub 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 down she goes, and is lost to sight. At which point, yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, I found it, destroyer skippers are a different breed of cat. They're just a different breed of cat, and Outer Bridge is no different. He brings this thing damn near alongside of this submarine after Mount Number Three hits it right at the base of the tower, and the hole just boop. And he said, because he relayed later that he could see like barnacles on it and all this other stuff that had grown on the hull. So I mean, he's close. He pulls past it, and as he pulls past it, he says it kind of breaches and kind of, does
Believe it.
a dying whale kind of a thing. And then when he goes past it, he orders four depth charges to be rolled off the racks of Ward, and
Just
kablooey,
making
off they
sure.
go. Yeah, yeah.
Right.
So to your point, he immediately sends a report in, quote, depth bombed sub operating in defensive sea area. Immediately. And I mean, like within minutes of him rolling those depth charges off the racks of that destroyer. He later, and by later, I think it's like 3 minutes later, he's like, maybe that needs to be a stronger worded message. So he sends off another one that says, quote, at 0653 to be exact, attacked, fired on, keyword there, depth bombed and sunk submarine operating in defensive sea area, unquote. And
That's pretty
as,
explicit.
yeah, but because he was afraid that the first message might be taken as, well, hell yeah, he is a greenhorn and he just killed a whale. And which was a common thing, unfortunately, for the whales in the Pacific in this time. But when he says he fired at, that means he saw it with his own two beady eyes. He saw that target and he ordered his ship to fire at it. So there's no mistaking that this wasn't a whale. This was a freaking submarine here. I put in notes, we should talk about how the report gets lost in the shuffle, and to an extent as to how. Because there's one of the aspects I think of Tora 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 that's a little bit meh. We talked about how accurate it is, but there are some things
It's
that are a little bit Hollywood.
right.
And this is one of them. The report gets lost in an in-basket somewhere and sent via Western Union, which to a degree it was. But the report, when Ward sends it off, it's cataloged. It's logged in the books by the naval radio stations that are hearing all this traffic. And it gets to 14th Naval District like now, like right now. They start acting on this thing almost immediately. But the situation is that it's Sunday. And not to make it an excuse, but it's Sunday. And people aren't really going to work on a Sunday morning in Pearl Harbor. So things are moving slower than they would have moved, say, if it was the following day, if this is a Monday morning,
That's absolutely right. So, yeah, I mean, the proper channels are being used here. It does get over to Logan Ramsey at Pat Wing 2. He gets the message and he's trying to confirm. But the bottom line is, to your point, that yeah, things are kind of working in slow motion here. He wants to be running to put up PBYs to maybe go off and patrol off to the northeast of the island, but that doesn't end up getting carried out before the actual attack starts developing.
It does not. So that Ward's second message goes off at 0653. At 0700, Kimmel's on the phone. They've got Kimmel on the phone saying, "Hey, Chief, somebody just, one of our destroyers just attacked and claimed that they sunk a
It's a
submarine operating off the mouth of the harbor." So in the 7 minutes, which is not a lot of friggin' time,
No.
frankly, they've got the Commander in Chief Pacific Fleet on the phone, and Husband Kimmel is aware that at the very least something has happened out at the mouth of the harbor. Wait, he can't confirm it, but he's like, okay, and he's literally still in his drawers.
Standing in his underwear.
Yes, and he's like, okay, I'll be right down, and he's starting to, now he's starting to get himself ready to go.
Gussed up and ready to go.
Yeah.
Did
I
you?
put it, go ahead.
I was just going to say that, as you put in the air the notes here, that the most serious error committed at this time was by the Navy. They never informed the Army that one of the Navy's destroyers had sunk an enemy submarine. And the point I would make is, yeah, that's all well and good, but if you don't have the inter-service communications
Very true.
protocols set up, there is no joint operations room at this point in time. How do you disseminate that information? Who is going to pick up the phone and call who to let someone in
Yeah.
the army know that something has happened?
One would like to imagine that Kimmel would have dialed up short and said, "Hey, brother,"
Yeah,
but as
right.
we know, that doesn't happen. But
It does not happen.
the thing that I put in the notes, praying says, "And in dawn we slept," and I loved this passage that he wrote in there. He says, "All this going down points," and I quote, "a picture of alert professionals at work, not going off half-cocked, nor taking the reports lightly." So there's that whole myth in our
Right.
minds that, oh, warden, nobody listened to warden. If they had listened to warden, all of this could have been averted. No, they did listen to ward, and they
Yes.
were going through channels, as you were saying. They were doing everything that they were supposed to do,
Yeah.
but they're simply, as we're going to see, not enough time. There's just
Yeah.
not enough time.
I think people too have a mistaken belief about what actually could have happened, even had Kimmel at 0700
Nothing.
said right then and
Very
there,
little.
yeah, put everybody to GQ and you know, wake everybody up and blah 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 blah. The ships could not have raised steam. There was no way steam boilers and all that stuff, man, that takes hours to get up to, you know, heat and get everything ready to go so you can actually make your way out of port. It's not like the age of gas turbines that we live in now, you know, that a warship is like, yes, turn on the engines and go. You know, that's one of the reasons we use gas turbines, because you can do that. You know, steam power plants are a completely different animal. So yes, going to GQ right now obviously would have made a difference. We would have had our ships buttoned up. There would have been ready ammunition at the guns. It would have made the first wave attack by the Japanese much more costly. But that's just not how militaries typically operate, too, particularly in the age of telephone communications. Once you get behind the eight ball in these sort of situations, it is terribly difficult to catch up. The beast is large. It takes a while to just kind of get it moving. And again, we're not on a wartime footing, and it's a Sunday morning.
Yeah,
This
and I
is
mean,
why they're attacking on a Sunday morning, because they are counting on this thing, you know, this sort of threat. Right.
exactly. I mean, it's 7 o'clock. If Kimmel understands the situation, and you can't blame the man here. I mean, you can't say, well, he should have known. He dude didn't know.
Yeah.
He doesn't have a crystal ball. If he would have understood what it was, you've got 55 minutes before those Japanese aircraft come down that mouth of that harbor, brother. There is nothing going to get moving but a freaking motor whaleboat
Yeah.
in that amount of time to get out of the harbor, as we're going to
Right.
see. Everybody's like, Nevada. Yeah, well, Nevada had already been working on this problem for
Right.
hours before.
Yeah.
So Fuchida is bringing his people in. Again, this is, rather ironic, as they're pulling in, the rising sun pops up, and it reminds Fuchida, according to what he says,
Of their flag.
of the national ensign, and it's a very
Yeah.
emotional moment for him and all this other. And around 7 o'clock, he instructs his radio men and his Kate. I think it wasn't him. It instructs his radio men and the Kate
Yes.
to turn into, or tune into rather, KGMB again. They pick
Again.
up the Hawaiian music. He realizes that, yeah, man, I can hear it in my mind's eye right now. My mind's
Looking
ear, I
good.
should say. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he, at this point, he's like, yeah, I think we're probably good. We're
We're
probably good.
Gucci. Yeah.
So Ward is not the only ones with eyes out right now. We're, of
That's
course, we're
correct.
talking about Opana Point. Let's riff on Opana Point here.
Yeah, so there's a piece of high ground at the northern part of Oahu. I've driven by it a number of times, and yeah, we had one of these. What was it? Is it
A mobile radar
SCR-70?
station,
Yeah,
yeah.
mobile
Yeah, something
radar.
like
It's
that.
up there, right? And these are relatively primitive beasts, and this puppy does not have anything like we would associate with the radar, namely the plan position indicator, you know, the rotating gizmo. No. Think more in terms of an oscilloscope. You've
That's
got an
exactly what it was,
A-scope
yeah.
that's, you know, giving you a big ping, and if you maneuver it correctly, you can kind of get a bearing off of this thing. This is not a sophisticated piece of equipment. But yeah, there are two gentlemen up there, two privates, Lockhart and Elliot, who are looking at this contact that suddenly goes bzoing at 0702, and they end up picking up the phone and calling down to Fort Shafter, which is actually down in Honolulu. It's right in the middle of the city there. You can still go there today and go and talk to the ready officer, who is our buddy Kermit Tyler.
Yeah.
Picks up the phone.
Tyler,
Unfortunately, yeah,
go
go ahead.
ahead. No, go
Yeah.
ahead. Go ahead.
I was just gonna say, I mean, Tyler, at least by some reports, isn't even supposed to be there that
Correct.
morning. He's only been there once before. So his job as pursuit officer is to take any radar reports and, a la, sort of Battle of Britain, be able to vector fighters out towards that contact and, get in touch with the fighter group. So he legitimately does have, I don't want to say the bat phone, but he could get in touch with,
Okay.
some of the airfields that have pursuit fighters, and he could dial those guys up if need be and get some assets up in the air. There's a problem here of communication in that Lockhart and Elliot do not give Tyler an indication as to just how big this blip is and how many aircraft it looks as if it might be, which is over 50, according to them. And so, without that piece of information in hand, Tyler knows that there's a group of B-17s that are supposed to be coming in from California this morning. He knows that those aircraft typically come in from the north, roughly. And so, upon consideration, he assumes that this blip that these two privates are seeing is these B-17s, and tells them over the phone, "Well, don't worry about it." And that is the end of that exchange.
That is the end of that exchange. And there's, I remember him saying, and I put that in the notes, he had said, that his friend, who was a B-17 pilot at Hickam Field, had told him specifically, yeah, when we come in from the mainland, they
Yeah.
play Hawaiian music all night long. Because back in the
Right.
day, a lot of times, past, I want to say like 10 o'clock or even sometimes midnight, the radio stations are shut down. Poof, it was dark, nothing.
Yeah.
So for a radio station to be playing music past, 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night was a pretty rare thing. It was a notable event. And Tyler, when he went to work that morning at 04, he climbed in his vehicle, fired up the Buick or whatever it was that he was driving, and he hears the music. And he remembered his friend saying, yeah, when the planes are coming in, we home in on that music.
Yeah.
And he knew that there was a flight coming in. So when he heard that music, he's like, ah, yeah, that's for
That's
the
what's going on.
B-17s coming in. So when he gets this phone call, it's
Logical enough conclusion.
completely logical,
Yeah.
completely logical.
Again, we are not at war.
No,
So, yeah.
no. And this is about 0720 when all this goes down, and Fuchida at this point is only 75 miles away,
Right.
ish,
Ish.
ish.
Yeah, and by
So.
the time they make their final shutdown at 0739, by now Fuchida is only about 20 miles away.
Yeah, they lose them in the mountain clutter, and then they pick them up again as they're coming in. And by that, they're like, shut it down, time to go to dinner or time to go to
Yeah,
breakfast. That's
breakfast.
it.
Yep.
So, an alert, I put this in the notes, and this is important because this would have been Short's call. This would have been General Short to say, okay, yep, we got a problem. And an alert at this point would have only meant a step up in readiness. Planes would have been dispersed, ammunition would have been passed out. And that is it. They would not have launched any fighters. I mean, to a degree, Tyler had that power, but even still, he had to call his boss. He couldn't call up Wheeler and say, scramble the, whatever squadron. It
Right.
doesn't work like
That's
that.
over Tyler's pay grade. It's kind of what
Big
it comes
time.
down to. Yeah.
Big time. So, according to, as I put, according to Short's orders, no fighters would have been scrambled unless he gave the order to do so.
Right.
And Short is out of touch right now. Like, nobody, to my knowledge, nobody decided to give him a phone call, unlike what they did at Husband Kimmel. So at 0735, Chikuma's scout plane is hovering over Pearl Harbor and observes the fleet at anchor. The pilot immediately snaps off a message describing the ships that were in the harbor and the weather report, which was partly cloudy and essentially very Hawaiian-like.
Yeah.
Then he turns around and heads back to the fleet. Fuchida
It's
clears.
unknown whether Fuchida actually gets that report or not. And understand too
Okay.
that these aircraft are they're operating with radio telegraphs, not with telephones. It's not like this dude is picking up the thing and actually yakking. I mean, he's got his backseater is doing that.
Yeah.
So in any case, it doesn't take that long though for Fuchida to figure out, just again, given the complete lack of fighter opposition and that sort of thing, and the fact that the radio station is still humming along in the background, that they have achieved surprise for this attack. And now it is time for him to make one of his most famous goofs. So the deal is that as they're coming in, they've got a plan. They've got two different plans in the kit bag, depending on whether surprise has been achieved or not achieved. If they are not in a surprise condition and they're going to have to sort of fight their way in, the game plan is that the dive bombers would go in against the anchorage first to sort of distract American attention and allow the torpedo planes to come in after and deliver their attacks. The problem with that is going to be that you don't want to do that optimally, because dive bombers doing their thing is going to create smoke and oil fires and all that kind of stuff, which could screw up the approach routes for the torpedo planes. So, optimally, the torpedo plane should attack first. The deal is that if Fuchida believes that surprise has been achieved, he is going to fire a single flare out of his command plane to let the whole force know that execute
We
plan
got
A.
him. Yeah.
We got him. Use torpedo planes, go in first. If we don't achieve surprise, we're going to fire two flares to let the dive bombers know, go and do their thing. So Fuchida actually is not coming in the way that he thought he was going to be coming in. There's heavy cloud cover over the center of the island. And so instead of flying right down the middle of Oahu, he ends up actually bringing his force around the western coast of Oahu, which already is going to create problems, because it means that the torpedo planes, instead of splitting up north of the harbor, are going to be splitting up to the west of the harbor, which means that their timing, according to Alan Zim, who's looked into this pretty extensively, would probably have been off in any case. But regardless, Fuchida fires his flare, and that's great, except that the fighter leader does not end up getting wind of this fact. Fuchida can see that the fighter guy is not doing what he should do in these circumstances. So he takes his plane up closer to the fighter leader and fires a flare. At which point the dive bomber commander, a
Sees
guy
two
named,
flares.
sees two flares. Oh, I guess surprise has not been achieved. We better attack. This guy, Takahashi, is the Hikutaicho of Shokaku. And so yeah, as a result, the dive bombers start gunning their engines and moving into attack. This is a problem. And with this. This is a real problem. Actually, it's going to have really big knock-on effects, because the premature attack by the dive bombers is going to alert the American defenders, and we'll talk about some of the ramifications of that vis-a-vis the torpedo plane attack later on. The bigger problem is that I don't think you can blame this completely on Fuchida. This ultimately, I think the buck stops at Genda's door in this case too. This whole business of using one flare, two flares is stupid. For exactly this reason, you can screw up. What if somebody doesn't see the first flare and they see, one
Right.
flare, two flare is dumb. You should have gone red flare, green flare, or something like that, that would have given a more positive indication as to what the actual plan was. And so the result is that whereas sort of the post-war mythology around this attack has always been, oh, it was carried off flawlessly, it's like, no, here's the first of the screw-ups. There's another major one in the second wave that we'll get to as well. But the result is that the anchorage is going to be coming under attack from two separate groups of aircraft almost simultaneously. But the dive bombers are going to get there first, and that's going to be bad.
And the dive bombers are going to be the first ones to make their attacks too. So, aboard USS Ogallala, which is an ancient tub there, there is a gentleman named Rear Admiral William Furlong. This was his flagship. He was the SOPA. He was the senior officer present afloat that morning in the harbor.
On this old scow.
On this old scow that he never figured he'd ever have to take in the battle either, by the way. He is the commanding officer, Battle Forces Pacific. As he's standing there on his bridge that morning, he watches a Val make a dive, drop its bomb, and pull out. And his immediate thought was, quote, "What a careless pilot," unquote.
That's a very charitable
Yeah,
assessment of
he's thinking this guy's career's ruined. He just dropped a bomb on friggin' Pearl
the
Harbor.
problem. Yeah, I'm gonna
As
just sit and rest, not
soon,
gonna look good.
yeah, I'm gonna crucify this guy. As
Yeah.
soon as he pulls up, this Val pilot, boom, the big red Hinamaru
The
right there
meatballs.
for all the world to see.
Yeah.
Furlong immediately recognizes that that is not a careless pilot. That is a Japanese pilot, and we are
Yes.
under freaking attack. He yells, quote, "Japanese, man your battle stations," followed shortly thereafter by, quote, "All ships in harbor sortie," which, as we know, some of them do because they're able to,
Yes.
but most of them can't. On USS West Virginia, or Weavy, as we call her, Ensign Roland Brooks saw the same explosion that Furlong saw and thought that something aboard California had exploded because the way the ships are lined up, Cali is
Right.
closest to the
To
seaplane
the
ramp on Ford Island, which is where the bomb went
yeah.
off.
Yeah.
So he sees this explosion go off and thinks, oh Christ, you know, something just blew up on California. We got a problem. He immediately sends away a fire and rescue party to go and aid California. What this does is actually it's a good thing for West Virginia because
Wakes
and
up
what's going to be a
the
it
crew. It
gets a
gets
lot
a
of guys that are
lot
in their rack up,
of pop
which is
on the
why
deck.
her casualties are significant, but they're not nearly as significant as they would have been.
Yeah.
And this is all, of course, just a twist of fate. So at this same moment, the Kates from Soryu and Hiryu are approaching the western side of Ford, lining up on what is, of course, USS Utah and USS Raleigh. Utah, boom, takes two fish immediately and begins to capsize because, as we know, she was an old battleship, Florida class, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
And she's a
Target
target
ship.
ship. Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Not exactly world-class watertight compartmentation or anti-torpedo systems on her. So yeah, she's going down immediately, and she's still there.
Yes, she is. Yes, she
Yeah.
is. So, Raleigh, which is right astern of her, if I remember correctly, she takes one torpedo, which floods both of her fire room one and two, and kills her power immediately. She begins to list hard to port as she's starting to roll. And again, you know, this it's a myth that, you know, the Americans just kind of stood there, boo, you know, as the attack's going on. No, dude, these guys almost immediately roll into action. Her AAA starts firing as she's starting to roll,
Yeah.
as she's starting to go over. They're breaking out weapons. They're running all over the deck. They're going to general quarters like right now. They are shooting back almost instantaneously. Let's talk about Peter Tomich. There's a lot of medals of honor that are awarded at Pearl or for actions at Pearl Harbor, and some of them, in my opinion, were awarded just because the guy was there. But this is not one of them. This is
Yeah.
a chief water tender, Pete Tomich, as they call him. He's aboard USS Utah. He's tending to the ship's boilers because that's his job.
Yeah.
As she takes the torpedoes, he immediately starts sending these guys topside, getting them the hell out of the
Get out
fire
of here.
room.
Get out of here. I got this.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
And
he's left down below watching the boilers. And it's difficult to envision just how you think of boiler rooms as being these huge spaces, and they are, you know, but they're all full of boiler.
kill a
And
machine,
they're
yeah.
often, yeah, they're often extremely cramped and difficult to maneuver through. I was just aboard the USS Midway back in February this year and got a tour, and they took me all through that ship, and I went down into some of the boiler rooms. And this is an enormous warship, And I swear to God, you're in one of those boiler rooms, the inboard boiler rooms, and it is cramped. Just
Yes, it
moving
is.
around there is really, really difficult to do. So now think about what it would be like in repeat that exercise when your ship is literally rolling over and you're trying to, operate at 25, 35, 45, 55 degrees. Things are going vertical on you. Yeah, it's a pretty in pitch darkness probably too.
Well, that was the thing. He was trying to tend to the boilers as best he could to
Keep power on.
keep power going. And as guys are getting out, he realizes pretty quick, he's like, "Oh, I got to get out of here." And by the time he tries to get out of there, of course, he can't. And he's still down in USS Utah right now. He's awarded technically the first medal. He's not awarded the medal, but he performs the action for which he is awarded the medal. He's the first one at Pearl Harbor, Peter Tomich, who was an immigrant from Eastern Europe. So let's talk about Matsumura. Matsumura is Hiryu's Kate strike leader. What
He
he,
yeah,
yeah.
and we've got a little diagram here that we should put up on the screen right about now that shows, first of all, just what the planned torpedo attack looks like. And the thing that's so striking here is that you can see that there are supposed to be Kates attacking basically from all points of the compass. But what ends up happening in the course of this operation is that the waters in Pearl Harbor are incredibly constricted. And not only that, but the harbor itself in many areas is surrounded by buildings. And that means that there are going to be updrafts as air is encountering those buildings. If you're a torpedo pilot, you do not want to be coming in at low level, then having to pop up over some of these warehouses in like the supply depot, and then pop back down on the deck to line up your shot against this battleship that is getting, right up in your face. These runs in many cases were less than 15 seconds. And if you pop up over that building, you might have only 3, 4, 5 seconds to get the shot lined up and tell your backseater to drop the fish. So what ends up happening in a lot of cases is that they picked an avenue of approach that gave them a longer
Longer
approach
front.
time. Yeah,
Sure.
which is why we're going to have this parade of torpedo planes coming up the southeast lock against Battleship Row. And the same thing kind of happens on the other side of Ford Island as well. In any case, in the course of that, Matsumura, who's the strike leader over on that side, recognizes Utah as a target ship, and I don't want to be wasting my fish on that ship. And he's also infuriated when he sees that some of the
Yeah,
less
he is.
experienced pilots are actually dropping against this thing. So he pulls up, goes across Ford Island, and heads for Oglala instead, which is moored outboard of the Helena. And so he now ends up on the other side of Ford Island and drops on her. So his torpedo, though, apparently goes right underneath Oglala, detonates against Helena, and there's a possibility too that a second torpedo may have actually hit right on the quay next to both of those ships as well, I believe.
Oh, okay. I didn't know
Yeah,
that.
but the result is that torpedo hit in that neck of the woods doesn't do that much damage to Helena, but Oglala, which is a tub, gets her seam sprung by this torpedo hit, and there's some classic footage of her just, I'm done. So, yeah.
She rolls over. And it's important to note, too, you were saying, well, Matsumura didn't attack Utah because it was a target ship. Well, why the hell is he attacking Oglala, which was a scow? Because that's the spot where Pennsylvania usually was parked.
Right.
Pennsylvania was usually tied up right there. And as
Yeah.
we know, of course, now Pennsylvania is in,
In
she's
the
in
dry
dry
dock.
dock that day. So Matsumura's other Kates, however, they wheel around, they go all the way back around, and they're coming in. Do they come in on the same approach as Murata, or in that general vicinity? Because
Yeah,
they're coming
I
up on
think they're,
Battleship Row.
yeah, they do. A number of them end up aborting and coming up there, which means that, yeah, there's none of them are going to be shot down. It's Kaga's Kates that really suffer in the southeast lock. But yeah, the bottom line is that the torpedo plan does not go off according to plan just because the pickings over on the other side of Ford Island, where Utah is, are so sparse that some of the pilots at least make an in-flight audible and decide to go over and attack other targets on the other side of the harbor. And the most likely of those targets is the battleships. So,
Big fat juicy targets.
yep.
So the men aboard those big fat juicy targets, they saw Murata coming in.
Yeah.
It's like a freight train coming at them. They saw him coming in.
Yep.
They believed, like everyone else did, because you got to remember, all this is happening within minutes. I mean,
Minutes.
it's not
Although,
like 20 minutes. It's like 2, 3, 4 minutes. Like boom, 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 boom,
well,
things are going
the
down.
torpedo attack, some of the Japanese accounts say that the torpedo attack as a whole, with all of the aborts and all of that stuff, may have lasted between 15 and 20 minutes. So, on average, they're coming down the southeast lock at least at intervals of, 20, 25 seconds. Some of them are stacked up tighter than that. And we know that by looking at the timing of some of the torpedo plumes. We can see them on the photographic record that in some cases there are three of those up in the air all at the same time, some going up, some coming down. Which gives you a rough sense for the cadence of these torpedo attacks, but it this was not over in 2, 3 minutes. It was a much longer duration because in
Sure.
some cases the Southeast Lock pilots as well couldn't get a good run, and they would abort and come back around and take another run at these things.
Right, but that's what I meant is that the guys on the battleships, when they're seeing Murata come in, it's
Yeah.
in the opening minutes of the attack. When the
Yeah, absolutely. It's very much at the outset. I mean, they're under attack by torpedo planes within a minute
What
or
I was gonna say,
two.
yeah, 2 minutes, 3 minutes tops.
Yeah, after the first bomb drops on Fort Island. And so here's that problem with the flares again. Yeah.
And then we go back to the boiler situation, and we're going to talk about Nevada extensively next week because her famous run is actually later on. But
Yeah.
her OOD that day was Ensign Joseph Taussig. And Taussig had, there was one boiler that had been lit throughout the night to provide power for Nevada. And he was going to shift power from one boiler to the next to give that one a, essentially give it a break. And he'd ordered a second boiler to be fired off at about, I want to say, 04 that morning. So this is why, to your point exactly, that even if Kimmel had said, everybody get out, it wasn't going to happen. The only reason Nevada was able to move like she did is because Taussig, of course, he didn't know. He had
Yeah.
that second boiler fired up for 4 hours before she ever, weighed anchor and started moving.
Yeah.
I put in the notes here, and I don't think this is arguable, but we need to make a statement here, is that Murata's attack is
Murata Shigaharu.
easily, it's the most devastating attack of the entire attack.
Absolutely. It is going to do the most aggregate damage to the battle line of any of the attacks that come in this morning. And Murata Shigaharu, he is Akagi's torpedo plane commander and is widely recognized within the Japanese fleet as the finest torpedo plane pilot in the fleet. And so he is the guy who has figured out how to get these planes down on the deck, deliver their torpedoes, these specially modified Type 91 torpedoes that are very shallow running, and get them into position to do their thing. So yeah, you're looking down the barrel if you're an American sailor at the probably arguably the finest torpedo plane squadron on the planet at this point is Akagi's, and Kagas are no slouches either. So yeah, these are some very bad dudes that are boring in on you at this point to do you harm.
And they are coming.
Yeah.
And I was unable to clarify because of the chaos of the moment which battleship first
I don't know.
took a fish. And
Yeah.
it's either West Virginia or
Or
Oklahoma.
Oklahoma.
Most accounts say it's West Virginia. In the
Okay.
end, it doesn't matter, frankly.
Yeah.
It really doesn't. But West Virginia's XO, a gentleman named Hillencoater, recalled, quote, "I was in my cabin just commencing to dress when at 07:55, the word was passed away fire and rescue party." This is when the bomb goes off, and they believe that California something blew up. This was followed about 30 seconds later by general quarters. At the same time, 0755, the Marine orderly rushed into the cabin and announced, quote, "The Japanese are attacking us," end quote. Also, just at this time, two heavy shocks on the hull of West Virginia were felt. It seemed as if these shocks were somewhere forward on the port side. Well, they were. By this time, I had reached the quarterdeck and the ship was beginning to list rapidly to port. I proceeded along the starboard side until just forward of number three turret, when there was a third heavy shock felt to port. The planes on top of turret three caught fire, and there were flames all around the turret top. There was another heavy explosion at this time that threw me flat on the deck. During all this time, the ship was continuing to list the port, and at that time of this latest shock, I should estimate that the list was about 20 to 25 degrees. He
That's
ballparks it.
uncomfortable. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's
That's
quick too.
scary.
That's within a couple of minutes. I called to the sound power telephone watch to tell Central to counterflood, but do not know whether or not this word got through. It did not, by the way. So, I mean, these hits. And again, it's important to understand this. And when we reviewed the Pearl Harbor footage, you can see it. And then you just said it. You see several plumes like boom, 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 boom going up. I mean, they're boom, boom, boom. They're
Popping
coming
off.
in, within minutes or seconds, even some of
Yep.
them. Aboard USS Oklahoma, the situation's not a whole hell of a lot different. It's absolute chaos on board ship at this minute. She absorbs at least nine
I think it's
torpedoes that
seven to
we know
nine
of.
I've seen, but
Seven to
yeah,
nine.
it's a lot.
And West Virginia gets about the same. It's seven to nine. I think I can't remember exactly
Something like
what it
that.
is.
We've got a diagram at the end of this that'll illustrate all of those hits too. So, yeah, it's a fair piece.
It's a lot of torpedoes.
And
It's a
Japanese
lot of.
torpedoes work. And there, you would think too that there wouldn't be any ambiguity in these numbers whatsoever. But the result, in some cases, is that it appears that some of the later torpedo hits ended up in exactly the same locations as earlier hits, and so you have an even bigger kaboom happening in that neck of the woods, and so it's almost impossible, you know, is this one hit or two hits or three? We don't really know. All we know is that, you know, the hull here is a mess.
Absolutely wrecked. And and this is where I think a lot of the mythology about Pearl Harbor comes into play, because at this time, aboard these battleships, most of the crews are, unless you got watch, unless you're on watch that morning, at that time, you're in your skivvies, you're rolling out of the rack, you might be eating chow, you may be going to work if you had to that morning aboard ship, but most of the crews are pretty much chilled out. So aboard Oklahoma, this is right before she gets hit. GQ does sound, because things are going haywire, and I found this to be rather funny. People are, saying, man your battle stations, and guys are just standing there like, what the hell's going on? And apparently somebody comes over the one MC on USS Oklahoma and says, and I quote, "Man your battle stations, this is no shit."
Let's make it
Apparently that
clear.
did the trick. Everybody's like, oh,
Okay. Oh, that's
okay,
legit then.
time to move.
Time to move.
So one of the guys I knew very well, a guy named Roy Swede Breen, he was in the paymaster's office on USS Oklahoma. And he was going to work that morning, because that day was payday aboard USS Oklahoma, and he
Sure,
was the
that's gonna be a busy
paymaster.
day.
Damn right it is. There's gonna be a lot of guys who want that cash.
Yeah.
And he was literally sitting there starting to dole out the cash and, make his little piles to pay the people. And as he's sitting there in his chair in his office, he hears that very same message. This is,
And
man your
this
battle stations, this is
typically
no
the
shit.
paymaster is going to be on the main deck, and so yeah, it'd be a teeny tiny little cabin, and he's probably got one porthole, and he looks
Exactly
out at
one porthole.
that's right.
Exactly. He looks out of the porthole and he sees a Kate, or what he says was a torpedo plane, which we know is a Kate. It had just dropped the torpedo and it went right over the area where his office was at that point. And he looked out and he immediately said, "The damn Japs," is what is his words, "are attacking us right now." And at that second, bam,
Boom.
torpedo hits the west, or hits the Oklahoma. As he said, and I remember this vividly, he says it sprung the door. He said the hatch was kind of half open, half closed, because he's in there dealing out cash. And it just springs the door right off the hinges, I guess, for lack of a better term. And immediately, like right now, the ship starts to roll immediately. And he said
Good
that hits
point.
just kept coming. It just kept coming. Bam,
Yeah.
bam, bam, bam. As he's trying to get out of the pay office, he's making his way, he's trying to make his way topside. And in just the minute, 2 minutes maybe, that he's trying to get out and get topside, that section of the hull is already, water is already starting to rise. He said that he had to slosh through the water to get to the top side. He does wind up obviously popping out of the top side.
Yeah.
And as the ship is beginning to roll, he immediately jumps off and jumps into the water and tries to swim away. And he's, as he's trying to swim away, the ship is continuing to roll because Oklahoma goes over like right now.
Yeah,
She
she's
did.
over in like 5 or 6 minutes or something like that. It's very,
Yeah.
very fast.
Yeah. It does
Which
not
again
take very long.
sounds like a lot of time, but that isn't a lot of time, if particularly if you're in the engineering department or something like that, and you're down below decks and trying to get up out of this thing, and yeah, that's not going to happen.
No. He winds up getting out and he does jump overboard and he gets away. He winds up swimming away. And but as he's trying to swim away, he said this. He said that as the ship was rolling, it was pulling him back and it kept pulling him back. Every time he'd get a little, it was kind of like 2 steps forward and 1 step back. He'd get away and then come back and get away and then come back. And finally, when she went over, and I don't know how long it took her to finally just turn turtle. But at that point, he was able to actually swim back to the Oklahoma because as he's getting out there, he's like, all this crap is flying through the air and water everywhere, you know, bullet splashes and shrapnel. And he's like, the hell with this, I'm not going out there. So he swims back to the Oklahoma and then swims his way around and gets on what is it, good gravy, Maryland, that's tied up alongside of her and gets up in there. But yeah, utter chaos that morning. Absolute utter chaos.
I was just going to say, did a little
Kenworthy. Yeah.
real-time history during our little break here. And yeah, Oklahoma takes 12 minutes to
12 minutes.
roll over. Yeah,
Okay.
12 minutes, which sounds like a lot of time. It is not a lot of time. Not,
Not when you got a crew full of a ship full of crew to get off of the
yeah,
damn thing.
right. All in your skivvies. One of the things that I'm sure that you would be able to remark upon too, having interviewed so many of these gentlemen over the course of your life, is just this whole war through a soda straw phenomenon, and how time gets telescoped. That when you're in the middle of a high intensity combat action like this, that things that took 10 or 12 minutes feel like they only took 30 seconds or something like that, because your memory is extremely episodic. You can't remember all the stuff that you did, but it seems like stuff is happening really, really quickly. And I'm sure that that would have been the case on Oklahoma here as well. That,
On any of them, but yeah,
yeah.
to you know, if you're saying that, you know, real time she rolls over in 12 minutes and Barine says that it, you know, it was five, well, to him it was five
Yeah.
because or less because, you know, exactly as you're saying, as these things are going down, he's remembering the highlights, he's
Yes.
remembering when that looking out that window and seeing that Kate, and
Right.
he's remembering when that torpedo hits and springs the door,
Yeah.
he's remembering trying to force his way out through the rising water in the battleship.
Yeah.
And to him, it was 5 minutes,
Right.
but clearly it isn't. And, you know, and I say that all the time when it comes to veterans' oral histories about, and we talked about this when we were doing the Nautilus stuff, you know, via the chat, is that guys, they look at things with blinders on. And it's not, that's not saying anything
It's
bad,
not wrong. Yeah.
but you're looking at what you see in front of you. You're not, I
Yeah.
mean, yeah, in some cases, Barine did, you know, he got up and he's looking around. And he goes, holy crap, you know, there's all kinds of things going on because he can at that time. But when he's on the ship, he's looking right here because he's trying, he's got one thought in mind, get the hell off of this
Out.
thing
Yeah.
now.
Yeah.
And the same thing for, you know, some guy at the Tenaru River.
Yeah.
He's looking at what's going on right in front of him. He doesn't know what the hell's going on down the river. So if somebody says, oh, I know what, you know, Bob Leckie did, you know, he was four positions then. No, you don't.
No,
You
you
don't know
don't.
that. But you do know what happened to you, maybe.
Yeah,
You know,
right.
so yeah, no, it's
It just speaks to the incredible you have to use these first person accounts very, very carefully,
absolutely.
because a lot of the details that they see are in fact legit, but trying to place that account within a larger Temporal context, if you will, is extremely difficult in many cases. So.
It is, and that's, and oral histories get a bad rap because of that. But if you, I hate to sound too big-headed, but if you know what the hell you're talking about when these guys are telling you these things,
You're able to fit it into that context.
you can figure out pretty quick if they're right or they're wrong. And you're not going to say, "No,
Right.
sir, you're wrong." You're not going to do that because you're not a complete rude ass. But you can sit there and go, "Okay, yeah, that's he's right, but it didn't happen now. It happened
Correct.
20 minutes later, or whatever the case
Yeah.
may be, or it wasn't on his left, it was actually on his right, but he remembers it for whatever reason." And you
Yeah.
have to be able to take the pieces, parts, and triangulate that into the story. You can't just take it verbatim
Right.
because 9 times out of 10, it did not happen like that. So you
Yeah.
really
And
got to
that,
know your stuff.
unfortunately, that is a problem with a lot of,
Yes.
I hate to say it, amateur historians when they read something in a book, this, well, this guy, he was there and he said this
Right.
happened, and then they just take it at face value, and it's like, you got to be very, very careful with this stuff.
Very,
You
very careful.
need to understand what's happening in the larger unit, or anyway, so.
Yeah, but it's 100% true. And that's why, like we're reading and we're fixing to read, something from Commander Jesse Kenworthy,
Yes,
who's
let's
on
do that.
USS Oklahoma.
Yeah.
And this was taken right after the event. He writes the after, here's portion of the after action report, like within days of
Yes.
Oklahoma. So it's the most accurate account available at that time.
And this is one of the things that my co-author Tony Tully, and he's done a lot of this kind of stuff too. He's really gifted at pulling apart first person accounts, and he's like, when in doubt, always take the account that it was written first or relayed
Yep.
orally first, because they typically are the least embellished and yeah, the closest to the actual events, and so the memory is not as affected by other people telling you what it is that you think you saw.
Exactly.
So anyway.
Or what you saw in a movie.
Yeah. Right.
So to that end,
To
Jesse
that end.
Kenworthy, Commander Jesse Kenworthy of the USS Oklahoma says, and I quote, "At approximately 0757, the word was passed to man the anti-aircraft battery, and the sound of gunfire was heard. The word was again passed that this was a real attack," and we already talked about that. For all unengaged personnel to seek cover. "As I reached the upper deck, I felt a heavy shock and heard a loud explosion, and the ship immediately began to list a port. Oil and water descended on deck, and by the time I had reached the boat deck, the shock of two more explosions on the port side was felt. I attempted to get to the conning tower over the decks, slippery with oil and water. I felt the shock of another very heavy explosion on the port side. By this time, the ship was listing 25 to 35 degrees and was continuing to list further. It was now obvious that the ship was going to continue to roll over, and I climbed over the boat deck towards the starboard side. Men were beginning to come up from below through hatches and gun ports, and like my buddy Swede. And from then, it was learned that the ship was filling with water in many spaces below. As I reached the starboard side, I met Lieutenant Commander Hobby, the first lieutenant, and with him concluded that the ship was fast becoming untenable and that an effort should be made to save as many men as possible." At this point, they call abandon ship on Oklahoma, which any guy with two eyes and gray matter in your head is already like, "Yeah, brother, I am gone.
I'm way ahead of
Goodbye."
you. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, gang. So you're probably sitting there going, "Where the hell's the canned closing?" Well, John and I rattled for a very long time on this particular episode because there was so much we wanted to talk about. And even then, there was so much we had to leave out just because of time. We figured we didn't want to rattle on too long. And then at the very end of the recording, we looked at how long it was, and we'd been talking for almost 3 hours. And that is just too damn long for any one show. So that being said, we're going to cut this sucker in half. So you will see the remainder of the first wave next week, followed by the second wave the week after that. So with that, we want to thank you very much for listening and or watching to this episode of the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast. As always, thank you very, very much for being here with us. Once again, my name is Seth Perrin, and I want to thank you. And on behalf of my fantastic good buddy and co-host, John Parshall, we want to thank you together for being here, and we will see you next week.